Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Game on 2FM.
Marie, I know you love when we start the top of the show with a bit of crack and chew the fat, but we can't get into it tonight. You surprised me last night with Aidan Fogarty. I've a little treat for you.
Oh?
Yes, we are delighted to be joined by RTÉ royalty and national treasure, Marty Morrissey. Marty, how are you?
I'm very well, Dunica, and delighted to be on your programme. And good evening, Marie.
Or as I would like to say, Claire Man, Marty Morrissey.
The bias comes out even after 30 seconds on air. I love it, Marie. Well done.
Do you know what? He's in Cork tonight, Marie, so I'm claiming him as a rebel. He's a rebel for an evening.
You can have him for one evening only.
Ah, yeah. I think
well, there's Cork blood, Dunnick. I was born in Mallow, so you're dead right to hold on. Whoa, just a little
there,
bit.
There you go.
Cork-born Clareman, as I keep telling everybody.
I knew the tan came somewhere, Marty.
And we can y'all. We'll do this to any man.
I'm saying it for years. Marty, you've had an incredible week. To be fair to you, I know Marie works hard in sport, but you've been on the road all week catching up on club championships.
Well, to be fair now, I have to give credit to my... because I've been away on holidays, Dunica, to be honest with you. So I only came back. My great friends and colleagues in the various correspondency around the country did a lot of the work during the week this week because, of course, it's a unique occasion. It's All-Ireland Club Final weekend in January because for many, many years, for many decades, the All-Ireland Club Final was on St. Patrick's Day, and there was a lot of sentimentality. I've been reading in the papers today where great players that I admire, like TJ Reid, he's kind of I suppose lonesome about it not being on St. Patrick's Day, but this is to try and condense eventually the club games into one calendar year. This is so it's going to be very interesting in so many ways because January 19th, 2020 is the first time the All-Ireland Club Finals are going to be played in Croke Park during this month. And it's also, in terms of the hurling, the first ever, which kind of is bizarre now, first ever All-Ireland Club Hurling Final between Tipperary and Kilkenny in the sense of Ballyhale against Barisalee. You think of all the years of club games and this is the first time it's happening. So it'll be interesting.
Marty, we're really in for a treat, I think, this weekend. I actually don't know which game I'm looking forward to most, but if we just start with the hurling that you mentioned there and just the calibre of players that are going to be on show, even if you just look through the 15s and even the squads, just the names, some of the names are like, they're dynasties in hurling, like the Fenleys, the Codys, the Reeds. It's unbelievable, isn't it?
It is. And I mean, they live and breathe in both places. I know both parishes rather well. I've been to Ballyhale many times over the years and been welcomed in TJ Reid's home and Shefflin's home as well and Henry's home. So I suppose their passion for hurling is unquenchable. And they bring that so many of the Fenleys and the Reeds and the Shefflins to the black and amber of Kilkenny. It is unique in the sense that Ballyhale are the reigning All-Ireland champions. They're out to defend their title. They'll be going for their 8th All-Ireland club title on Sunday. And when you have somebody like Henry Shefflin in charge, and first year in charge last year, he won the All-Ireland. But when you look through their team, as you say rightly so, Maria, that it's TJ Reid, there's the Adrian Mullins, there's Joey Hull. These are names we associate with Kilkenny in Croke Park on All-Ireland Final Day. And then Brendan Maher, he was 31 last week. And what a season he's having. I mean, he's just outstanding. And that wonderful point against St. Thomas's when he broke his hurley, the ball came down to him again, and without complaining or without looking for a hurley, he just grabbed the slither and sent the ball over the bar with a broken hurley. Now, it is bad enough. Plebs like you and I, Dunica, and I know you play at international level. Try putting that over the bar under pressure, All-Ireland Club semi-final with an ordinary hurley, with a fully operational hurley, is something else. But to do it with a broken hurley is fantastic. I am aware that, you know, both parishes have had a lot of tragedy over the last many months. And this hurling has brought a little bit of joy in the Valley of Darkness. And for those two clubs on Sunday to get to Croke Park and to line out in an All-Ireland final, whether it be January 19th or March 17th, is very, very special for these two communities. And it goes deeper than just a game of hurling. It is about the community. And it is about having a moment of joy, having a dream fulfilled to see their jersey Jerseys in Croke Park. While Ballyhale have done it many times, Barsalee's journey has been phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. When you think Johnny Kelly came in, their first game was Glenelty Ross Moore last April. I think it was April 1st, if I'm not mistaken. And here they are, whatever that is, 9 months later. I'm not good at maths at this early evening. Get out my laptop or my mobile phone. Here they are heading to Croke Park. So it's an amazing, I hate the phrase, it's an amazing journey, but it is a journey. For these two communities.
Marty, another thing it's going to be and should be is an absolute cracking game of hurling. People are expecting Brendan Maher to pick up TJ Reid, which would be interesting if he did. And unfortunately, when that happens, often the two really great players cancel each other out. But other players tend to step up as well. Who do you think are going to be the players that will step up for both sides?
Well, I mean, I mentioned them already. You look at Adrian Mullen and you look at Joey Holden. These are two players, both defensively and in attack, who have absolutely volumes of experience. And you don't have to... I was doing MC at the Munster Council Awards before Christmas, and the Barsalee lads arrived in. And they ranged in age from... And they were all done up in their black ties and they looked very handsome, I must say. Dashing, absolutely. And they I just asked them, what old were they? And they went from 18 to 22. And here they are in an All-Ireland club final. They might lack experience of the big time in Croke Park, which I think might be a factor for them. But they're coming through minor and under 21 ranks. And when you have somebody like Brendan Maher is vital to them. There is no question. You look back at the games against Ballygunner and against Glen Rovers and against St Thomas's. Brendan Maher, although he was 31, as I said last week, TJ Reid is 32. It ultimately, I think, will come down to a battle between these two players. I actually hope they're not on each other because I'd like both of them to sparkle because I love both of them. Yeah. And they both will have an influence, but it's going to be an interesting contest.
Marty, you mentioned it there about the parish, the community, even mentioning the age. It doesn't matter really when it comes down. There's something spiritual about representing where you're from and what you're about. And that's what we hope to see.
Absolutely, Duncan. I mean, you know, you've done it at the highest level in your game. And playing international rugby must be one of the greatest achievements for any person, or soccer, or whatever.
I don't know. My gran would have preferred if I hurled for Cork. She would have taken the Irish caps, thrown them up, just hurled for Cork.
That would be the ultimate thing, yeah.
The ultimate.
Yeah. So, like, and it's just, and Tipperary hurlers, Kilkenny hurlers would say it's great to play in the Tipperary jersey or the black and amber Kilkenny, but ultimately, it's about playing for your club. You went to national school, you went to secondary school, you went to wherever, to college, but ultimately you always come back to your club. And that's why, the TJ Reeds and Brendan Maher, as I keep emphasising, they epitomise for me the true spirit of the GA. They played the game at the highest level, but yet the club is everything. And I remember reading when Barsalee won the Tipperary Championship or after the Munster Club title, Brendan was asked, you know, you have your All-Ireland from this year, but... you know, how does it compare? He says, nothing compares to the club. I'm paraphrasing now rather than quoting accurately, but it's the same. Every player will say it. And I'm sure same with you. If you won something here in Cork, it would mean as much to you for lads that you grew up with, Dunica.
Yeah, absolutely. Even just today, it was at the Cork on lunch. That's my club. That's where I'm from. It's what I'm about. And it's like, Marie, we've had it as well before where players and the All-Stars, and it's the first thing they mention. It's going to be great to bring it back to the club.
I think it'll be special. It'll be interesting to see what the attendance will be like, Marie, because this is new. Barsalee, I know, are gone stone stark mad. I've been there. I was passed through there a couple of weeks and the colours were fantastic. Ballyhale are a little bit more experienced. They're more used to Croke Park, and it might just come down to that advantage that Ballyhale have. But my word, I mean, don't rule out Barsalee because they've come through an amazing championship through Tipperary when they looked to be in trouble, I think, if I'm not mistaken, against Clonauty Ross Moore in the first game, and they've come through. And since Johnny Kelly came in, he's given them a great self-belief, so that they really have done well. It's a good combination, and it's Tip against Kilkenny. Hello, all bets are off
box
here.
Box office.
Yeah, box office. I love it.
There's a football match on as well, Curraghfin and Kilkenny, two very very different sides. Curraghfin are probably going to try and become, if they're not already, the greatest ever club team by winning on Sunday. But then you have Kilcoo. They've been evolving, improving all season long. It should be a really great battle, Marty.
Yeah, I mean, Curraghfin for me have played the champagne football in Croke Park. They've won the last two All-Ireland finals with over 10 points to spare. And they haven't been playing... no-gooders in terms of football. You're talking about Nemo Rangers, the kingpins of Cork football. You're talking about Dr. Crokes, and they just played fantastic football. I remember various members of our analytical team on the Sunday game saying, you know, people should play football like Curraghfin at intercounty level. Now, that is an ultimate compliment, I would think. And Curraghfin have been outstanding. And yet... you know, here they are going for three in a row. Kevin O'Brien is clearly a very good manager, but they have quality footballers in Gary Sykes and Liam Silk and Kieran Fitzgerald and Micheál Lundy, who's joint captain. They've done seven in a row in Galway, and they came through Galway through tough challenges. Last year, Mount Belumoyloch held them to a draw in the Galway County Final. This year, Tuam Stars did. But once they get out of Galway, well, then all the shackles seem to be off. And they are particularly good when they come to Croke Park. They just have, there's extra oxygen in the lungs, there's extra space along the sidelines. They are just beautiful to watch. Now, but hold on now. Here comes Kilcoo, without forgetting about them. Because Kilcoo have come through a tremendous championship, through down. They won six down championships between 2012 and 2017. While Curraghfin have won seven in a row in Galway. This is really, you don't do this by fluke. Seven in a row in Galway, six in a row in County Down, 2012 to 2017. They lost the 2018 championship. They came back in 2019. They brought in, I suppose, outside thinking in Mickey Moran, Conlett Gilligan, who was a great footballer for Derry. But Mickey Moran is coming, like, we have to acknowledge Mickey Moran must have some bit of magic, because whatever club he goes to, whatever county he goes to, he brings them up a notch or two, to his great credit. And I think that Kilcoo, who looked very impressive against Ballyboden and St. Enda's, and I was talking to Michael Darren McCauley actually during the week, and he gave full credit to Kilcoo. Now, he felt that Ballyboden didn't play well themselves, but that having been said, he was very honest and very modest and very praiseworthy of Kilcoo. He thought they were a really good footballing side. So this is going to be interesting. Curraghfin will be favourites here. It's Kilcoo's first time to Croke Park. But they come with a swagger and a confidence. They're a very small community. They certainly have gone mad as well. My colleague Gail from the Belfast office visited Kilcoo, and the pictures she brought back to me were just fantastic. They're singing all sorts of different songs. Now, mind you, some of them have the Dublin tune or Dublin air, but it doesn't matter. The words are brilliant. And they're magpie countries, the kingpins of Ulster, first Ulster title. And they will come and they will not lie down to Curraghfin. So it's an intriguing, intriguing Sunday that we can look forward to. And while it's cold and frosty, and it will be, obviously, we'll be covering it live on the radio on RT1. It'll also be highlights that night. And obviously, TJ Carroll will be covering it live that day. I would encourage everybody to come out on Sunday. Support these great clubs. Ballyhale against Barisalee. And may I give also credit to Shlock Neal of Derry, because they gave a right scare to Ballyhale in the semi-final. And it's lovely. It's wonderful to see that development of hurling in Derry, and hopefully it'll give them a bit of confidence. And I don't say that in a patronising way. It's sincere. I love Shlock Neal. They developed the Irish language. I went up last year, 2 years ago, and they developed this village, and everybody speaks Osgaeilge, and they only did it in the early 90s. I mean, they're a unique community. But anyway, we'll talk about Shlock Neal when they get to the final next year. Ballyhale against Barisalee on Sunday.
Marty, this will come as no surprise, and to our listeners, this will come as no surprise either. We've got our very first request for a shout out, and of course it's for Marty. Davina has texted in and she wants to know if she can get a shout out for Philip Kenny. He's one of the selectors on the Barisalee team. He himself won the final. His father did too, and now his two sons are playing. So a shout out, I imagine, is from Marty she's looking for.
Well, all I can say is Philip Kenny is a legend in Barisalee, and we wish him and all his family the best of luck on Sunday in Croke Park. And I'll be there myself, and I look forward to meeting them and all the crowd from the various clubs.
It's amazing, moments like that, and I've seen you walking around, Marty. People obviously gravitate to you an awful lot. I know you're a proud Clareman, but it's like you're the soul and voice of our game.
Well, thank you, Donica. Well, that's a compliment. I'm only part of the team, and Marie, yourself, we're all part of the sports team. It's a privilege to work in this area of broadcasting and to work for RTE. So, I mean, I've always treasured it. So there's nothing special at all. It's grand.
You're being modest. It would be wrong to get you tasked for results, but what do you hope for these two matches?
Well, can I also mention one other thing, Dunnick, if you don't mind, because, and it's probably unusual, Conaghy Shamrocks are playing Father O'Neill's in the All-Ireland from Cork in the All-Ireland Junior Championship Final. And that's going to be at 4 o'clock tomorrow, Saturday. And the man who's in charge of that game is Sean Stack. And Sean Stack is son of the great Sean Stack of Clare. And he's a young...
Smile Bridge.
I was about to say it, Marie, where Marie is from. And it's great. I'm just delighted for him on a personal basis. There's a young referee coming up from Waterford, Dunica. And I know referees don't always get applause or get the spotlight, but Thomas Walsh has made a great reputation for himself from Waterford. He's refereeing the Father O'Neill's versus... Tullerone All-Ireland Intermediate Hurling Final. Declan Dalton is an up-and-coming star, former Cork underage goalkeeper. He's a really good forward. I'm looking forward to seeing him. But Thomas Walsh will be refereeing the game between Father O'Neill's and Tullerone at 6 o'clock. So just a little an acknowledgement there to the two referees. OK, you asked me to call it. I think this is going to be very close. I think Corrifin will probably win the three in a row because of their vast experience. Ballyhale probably in the All-Ireland Hurling Final, but I have a sneaky feeling there's something about Borrisilly that I love, and whether it's the mascot that they have of the cock that's been there for 40 years or whether it is Brendan Maher's form at the moment, Borrisilly just might sneak it.
Donica, before you say goodbye to Marty, would you give a shout out for the Punters Council, please?
Yes, absolutely. We're looking for people within their clubs or communities or charity of your choice to consider the Punters Council tonight. All you have to do is text your name, where you're from, to 51552. There's been an awful lot of great charities and there's been some good tips. So Leon Blanche will be on later on from Boyle Sport to help us out with that. Marty, as always, thank you so much for coming in. Let's hope for... two great games, and thanks for joining us.
Not at all. It's my first time on the programme with you and Marie. And Marie is a good friend of mine for years, and you're a great friend of mine for the last number of years. And I see you around the office, and I wish you the best of luck in Game On, and delighted to be first time on with the two of you.
Thanks so much, Mark.
And hopefully one day we'll get you to play hurling and make that granny proud.
Welcome back to Game On. There's an incredible buzz. Marie, it's crazy. Anytime Marty's around, there's a fanfare. He's like a walking version of the Beatles.
I made a huge mistake a few years back. I invited him to my wedding. And not one person asked me for a photo, for a selfie. It was just, where's Marty? Have you seen Marty? I need to go and get a picture with Marty.
It's brilliant, though. One thing you must say, he's so giving of his time, isn't he? Not just, I know for us, you know, because he's a colleague and a teammate, but just everyone that he's around.
He's one of the biggest, if not the biggest stars in GAA.
Yeah, absolutely. OK, it's time to move on to rugby, and it's the final round of the Champions Cup, where rugby fans sit around with their abacuses, like we were saying, working out all the implications. And tonight we're delighted to be joined by BT Sports' Craig Doyle. Craig, how are you?
Good, yeah. Calculator at the ready.
Yeah.
And my word, I need it. It is one of those weekends, isn't it? There's something on every single game, so it's exciting. Yeah, we're looking forward to it.
The big story in town, though, is Saracens. No better man to tell us what's going on.
Well, I mean, it's first of all, isn't it sad that we've a brilliant final round of games in the Heineken Champions Cup, and we're talking about Saracens again, and it's really disappointing that. So, look, I'll give you the quick 10-second tutorial if you've been living under a rugby rock for the last year. Saracens were found to be in breach of the salary cap. The salary cap in the English League is 7 million quid. You're allowed to have some marquee players above that, but let's call it 7 million quid. If you go above that salary cap, you're in breach of it, and the fines range from points are a few quid. Now, the maximum number of points that can be deducted is 600. And this is the one listed. Okay, these are what they've listed in terms of what can be deducted. The highest number figure over their salary cap is listed at £650,000. And for that, you get a 35-point deduction and then, of course, the fine as well. So we don't know exactly what figure Saracens have gone over the salary cap because they can't release those numbers. But that was the first story that broke, that they were found to be in breach of the salary cap, a 35-point deduction in the league and 5.3 million quid fine. And we thought, hopefully, that's them done and dusted. But, of course, that was only based on the last 3 years of them playing in the competition. And everyone's going, well, what's happening this year, currently? Because we haven't seen any huge changes from the end of last season to this season. So have they ditched a load of players? Have they cut the salaries? Have they offloaded a load of finance that allows them to be under the salary cap? And that was the question everyone asked. So that's where we were. Okay, so that's where we were at this stage. And then I should just say as well, everything you're reading at the moment, and there's a lot of it out there, is kind of largely speculation, rumour, and also leaks, because Premiership Rugby Limited, who run the basically the league in England, it's kind of, they are like almost agents for the clubs in the Premiership. They represent them, and they can only do things that the clubs ask them to do. So if the clubs say, you know, actually we want you to do something with Saracens, they'll do it. But if they say we'd rather you didn't release all the details, they won't. So that's why it's hard to get facts in this whole story, and why there's been so much speculation and rumour up to this point. Okay, are we up to scratch in the story so far? Shall I bring it in a new bit?
Yes. Do you, Craig? Yeah. Okay. I was just reading before you come on there, just in the last 30 minutes, that there seems to be news that Saracens are telling their players that they're going to be relegated, that they've almost accepted it.
Again, not fact, but fairly good speculation, I would say. What happened then? We're at a stage where we don't know whether they're under the cap for this current season. And I guess what all the players wanted to, all the other clubs wanted to see, was Saracens make a big statement, offload some key players. We know Liam Williams was going. Was that enough? We don't know. Also, the report, not everyone had read the details of the report. Okay, you're not allowed. You have to sign an agreement not to release any details of the report if you do read it, if you are an owner of a club. And so details were sketchy. But what we found out is over the past couple of weeks, since the report came out, since the ruling came out, the directors of rugby, the owners of the clubs are going, hang on, they're way above what we expected. And we're pretty annoyed about this. And that's what's happened since. So the clubs basically, last Tuesday, all the other clubs met and said, right, Saracens, we want to see you do something about this, because from our reckoning, you're still above the cap. Now, in fairness, Edward Griffiths, who's been brought in to help with this fire sale at Saracens, said, yeah, we are above the cap at the moment and we're doing our best to get below it. Now, they've had 2.5 months since that report came out to sort it out, and they haven't sorted it out. And basically, the headline is, last Tuesday, all the other clubs had enough and said, you have a week to get your act in order. So over the past week, Saracens have been trying to offload players, sell them on to other clubs, lower the wage bills, do everything they can. And they just can't do it. 7 days is just not long enough. Now, your next question might be, well, hang on, you've got Mauro Toji, you've got Billy Vunipola, Maka Vunipola, Owen Farrell. These are some of the best players in the world. Surely the other clubs in the Premiership will take them. Well, it's the first time it's happened in a while. All the other 11 clubs are almost on the 7 million salary cap. Usually they might have a few quid kind of stashed away that they can still spend, but more or less all the clubs have spent up to the limit. So they physically are not allowed to spend any more money on players. So there's no home for the stars of English, stars of world rugby to go to. So they're in this weird kind of zone. What are you going to do with these guys? So literally, you can't sell them on, you can't get your wage bill down. What's the next step? Well, if you're above the salary cap by the end of next week, folks, you're gone. You've got to take relegation. And that is what we believe. That's the story is today, that there was a meeting with the players at 8:30 this morning at Saracens where they said, guys, we can't get below the salary cap. We're going to have to accept relegation. We're going to have to map out some kind of plan. And that's what's happening. I mean, the pressure now is on Saracens to make a statement. The pressure is on Premiership Rugby to make a statement. But look, there's no doubt about it. This is, quite simply, the biggest story to hit club rugby in England, in Europe, ever. It's massive.
Doyler, just on that, both of us know how tough the Premiership is. Like, it is a grueling, grueling league. If Saracens were to go down, if they were to lose so many key players, could this be a massive, like, could this swing the end of that club?
Could do. It could do. I mean, you know, once you get into the Championship, you know, you're not in control of your future really so much anymore, are you? Because you don't know what's going to happen next. You don't know, are you going to, it's not as easy to come out of the Championship as people might think. They're going to be, you would imagine, if they're going to stay below the cap, trying to get out of the Championship without all their star players. Can their star players sign off for another club for a year? Well, maybe some of them will go to France I think a lot of the speculation in the papers today, they won't be able to play for England. That's not quite true, because I do remember when Stephen Armitage was over playing in Toulon, and a lot of people wanted him playing for England, and they found a clause in the RFU contract which said, actually, in special circumstances, a player can come back and play for England, even if he's not playing his club rugby in England. And I think in this case, you could argue mid-season fire sale, can't get homes for the players in England. You could say if they went abroad, they'd be you'd find a reason there for Eddie Jones to get them back and play for England. But still, it's not ideal. You go down to the Championship, a tough old league down there, you haven't got your stars, a couple of seasons, maybe you don't come out. Saracens have spent a lot of money on their ground. Would they be filling it anymore? I mean, they don't always fill it anyway. It's not like a Welford Road where they get 24,000 in a week. You know, maybe 8,000 in. They're building a new stand there. Yeah, it's different. It's really, really difficult, because it's not like one of the older clubs that you feel will always exist at that level, because it's in the genes, it's in the blood of the area, like Gloucester, like Leicester, like Northampton. It's not quite like that in North London. You've got a lot of other options. It's a very, very dangerous time for them.
And Craig, I think over here people are going to be curious about what it means for their status in the Champions Cup.
Well, they'll remain in this year's Champions Cup, no doubt about that. Although if they have to offload a load of their star players over the next 7 days, you might want to draw them in a quarter-final, because they mightn't be as loaded as they usually are. It's interesting, the team they've got this week is fairly loaded. A lot of the big names in that. It could be the last time we see some of these guys in the Saracen shirt. So it's a big old deal. So they will play in this this season's Champions Cup. If what we're hearing is true and they are going to be relegated, well, they might just target the Champions Cup, because it doesn't matter what they do in the league anymore, they're going to be relegated. So maybe they're going to be tougher. But what players will they have in that? Here's the real problem. What if they win the Champions Cup? Well, you know, the EPCO ruling, they don't go by salary caps. Not that they don't care about salary cap breaches, but it's not in their rules. What is in their rules is that to compete in the Champions Cup, you have to be either in the Pro 14, the top 14, or the Gallagher Premiership. And if what we're hearing is happening, Saracens may not well be in the Premiership next season.
Wow. Craig, as always, thanks so much for joining us. I know you have a huge weekend with BT Sport, so we'll allow you get home, get watching the Late Late with the old face mask on. No better boy for it. Thanks for joining us on Game On.
Yeah, 10 games this weekend. Join us for the season, folks. Bye.
Thanks. Marie, staying on rugby, to preview all the Irish interests, we're joined by the two Brendans. One can type 60 words in a minute and the other can deal with a ton going through his shoulder blades. We're delighted to be joined by Brendan Fanning and BJ Botha. Lads, how are you?
Hi, Donis. How's it, Marie? How's it, Brendan?
Which one is which?
Oh, we stick with BJ, World Cup winner. He's got great typing skills, Brendan Fanning. Yeah. Brendan, I'll go to you first. Incredible news about Saracens, isn't it?
Yeah. From the moment it broke, I think Leinster and Racing, the other, and Toulouse would have been looking at this thinking, well, this might work out if we get into the knockout stages of Europe. Who knows what conditions Saracens will be in. But nobody saw what came earlier today. And I rang PRL a couple of weeks ago, Dunica, and asked them, was there a date by which Saracens had to be cap compliant? I wondered at what rate they would have to start offloading bodies or cutting salaries in order to get under the lid. And the response I got was that it was kind of fluid. It was a bit of a moving target, which seemed odd. And then we got the story breaking today. So initially I thought, well, that players' meeting might have been Sarri's backing their players into a corner, saying, look, lads, if you're not prepared to wear 50% salary cuts across the board here, we're going to be relegated and we could be going out of business. So we really don't know what happened at that. But by any stretch of the imagination, it's an amazing story. And it's a disaster for Saracens, who were, up until quite recently, the brand leaders in European rugby.
BJ, we'll move on from it, but just before we do, Saracens are known as the wolf pack, but you know a team dynamic. Sometimes you have to keep the wolf from the door. And will they split now as a squad? You know, do people start thinking about their own income, their own family, what they have to do, or do they stay tight?
Yeah, Dunnes, it's really a rot old mess, you know.
And probably what I feel most for is the players, really, as you mentioned now. You know, I suppose the culture that Saracens have built has basically, you know, stood them in such good stead through those big games, you know, semi-finals and finals. And that's where you kind of, you know, gain that winning edge, really, is that team culture that you've built over the years, you know, building that through the academy system, you know, building that winning culture and then up to the guys that are coming through. So very difficult to say now. You know, I think they... You know, the players, they are, you know, paid for one reason, is that and that is to perform on the field. And now they've got all these other issues to contend with. And the big one there is, are they going to be playing their rugby at Saracens, the, you know, the club they love to play for and don't want to leave, but, you know, might be forced to leave. So it's a tough and kind of a sad situation for the players.
Yeah. Okay, we'll turn our attention to the Irish interest, and we'll start with Connacht. They play Montpellier on. Brendan, just for you, disappointing match that this is a bit of a dead rubber for Connacht, but what do they need to get out of it?
Oh, well, according to Andy Friend last week, after the defeat by Toulouse, what they need to get out of it is a win, which is a fairly tall order going to Montpellier. Fairly tall order given the circumstances of the win that Connacht got them over them in round one. Now, they are reasonably well tooled up. The spine of their side is strong. It's interesting to have Kieran Marmie and Jack Carty back at halfback, which is the first time since early November. And their careers have taken an interesting turn since the start of the season. I think most people would have reckoned Marmie was kind of nailed on to go to the World Cup. And if you track back to kind of halfway through or a third of the way through the Ireland-Japan game in the World Cup, you would have thought that Jack Carty was going really well, comes home, loses his place in Connacht. So having the two of them back on deck together, I think will be certainly a point of interest for Connacht fans. And they can't wait to get Europe out of the way and get a little bit of a break, because they're pretty banged up and they've had four games where they haven't had a lot of joy, and you get the distinct feeling from Andy Friend that he just wants to get back into the corner and get a breather.
Brendan, what did you make of Andy Friend's comments about fringe players from Leinster moving around to other provinces?
I think there's an inevitability to it, given the demographics at play here, and that Leinster have more players coming through into their system than any of the other three provinces. And there is already a de facto trend for players who weren't getting a run in any of the other three to go to Connacht. And then that policy was given impetus when David Nusifora came in, and he reckoned that the best way to utilise resources was to move players from one province to another when they weren't getting enough game time, which makes absolute sense in, well, I won't say in a lot of regards, but certainly in the most important, which for him is the Ireland team. So yeah, I don't think Andy Friend was saying anything that wouldn't have been echoed widely.
BJ, turning attention to the Munster game, Munster taking on the Ospreys. You know, a few changes, Finian Wycherley coming into the second row, Calvin Nash onto the wing. You know, tough game for Munster, still something at play, but how do you see this going?
Yeah, a tough one coming off last weekend. You know, I think Munster performed, and I suppose in one part you probably didn't finish off a lot of the plays that they created. You know, came away there with not much, and I suppose looking up to this back to Tom and Park again, and as you just mentioned, a couple of young guys on the bench, and one or two making their starts, and we have obviously one or two, you know, major players like Keith Hill's missing. So look, we're going into this game as Munster with, I suppose, one thing is that's going to be a massive performance, and I don't think anything less than kind of outrightly 5 points will do, you know, and I think the players will put that on themselves, you know, performance for 80 minutes, you know, they've got this opportunity, and kind of give them that best opportunity to get to 16 points, and we've seen ourselves, you know, that 16 points get you into that top eight, and that's all they can kind of hope for at the moment, which is it's not in their, you know, completely in their hands, but they can do as much as they can to have that.
Brendan, I was lucky enough to play in a game called the Miracle Match. Do Munster need more than that?
Different circumstances, Dunica. When you played in that game, it was all about that one game on the day and what you did, and there weren't so many moving parts, whereas in Munster's case there's lots of moving parts. It's like It's like an accumulator bet where there are about you're putting a few bob on about four or five things, none of which in their own right are wildly off the charts. For example, if Munster need Lyon to beat Saints in Lyon, you know, French team playing at home, albeit nothing to play for, there's a reasonable chance that that might happen. For Glasgow to get nothing more than a draw and Sale, yeah, that's eminently doable. For Racing to beat Sarries, who knows what mental state Sarries are going to be in for that. Would Toulouse be able to beat Saints in Toulouse? Well, according to Jerome Pino, after the Connacht game last week, he couldn't wait for that game and to sign off on a positive note. So it is possible, but yeah, obviously it's unlikely.
Donica, for players then, is it hard to prepare a match for a match like that when, as you said, you need a miracle?
Yeah, this is a tough one. We had the exact same situation. We lost to Toulon over there, and we were coming back to play London Irish. And you know there's hope. Well, in that case, we were out, and we were just so, so flat. It's a really dangerous game, Marie, like in terms of everyone's just nearly taken the 5 points for granted, but you have to go out and earn that. And BJ, you know it as well. Sunday will be very difficult for that Munster team. You know, I know there's all the other outside factors that can affect it, but just gene yourself up from, you know, not having it in your own control.
Definitely, that's very true. You know, kind of it's that underlying cover that's just above you. And I suppose what's added to that is Munster have beaten Ospreys three times this season. You know, twice away and one at home. So you know we need to be up for it in that sense as well. We can't just take it for granted to one part. You know, hope that things happen and kick on. So I suppose the crowd will be there, and as much so part of the performance. And you know, I think that's probably most important, to kind of give the crowd what they kind of reserve, and the players to go out there really and to kind of give as I said as much as they can on that day, and give them the best shot at hopefully qualifying, even though it's a very slight chance.
Brendan, Leinster taking on Benetton, is this a banana skin? Leinster going for top seeding, but Benetton are, you know, over there can be a difficult place.
Well, if it is a banana skin, that is a banana skin that's clearly evident lying on the pavement in front of you. So Leinster being the top team in Europe, they need to, or certainly up there with Racing and Saracens in when Saracens are in full mode. It's a question of stepping over that banana skin. Benetton are a one from six in this competition for a reason, and they're four from ten in the Pro 14 for a reason, which is that they're, despite having done pretty well last season and played some really, really good rugby, they haven't been able to kick on and get to that same level again. So yeah, they'll be difficult, but Leinster have, I think we've mentioned it here before, Donica, and I'd say BJ would recognise this or appreciate this. There is nothing as powerful in a playing group as competition for places. So Leinster fellas know if they don't perform, then they're gone.
Yeah, and looking at competition for places, BJ, when you look at that back row, Caelan Doris, Josh van der Fleer, Max Deegan, not only are they competing for Irish places, but just in this dynamic, they will be competing against each other on the pitch to try to grab those green jerseys, won't they?
Exactly, as we know, you know, Six Nations coming up and squads being announced, you know, that pressure has just added to that part. And, you know, as Brendan just alluded to, their competition, there's nothing that drives a team, you know, better than competition. And we know, as much as they want to drive that, drive the province on, you know, their eyes are looking just above to that green jersey, and they will know in the back of their minds, you know, to put their performance in for Leinster will quant massive onto the Irish jersey.
Yeah, and then so if I was to get you to call that, lads, I think that's one way, really, isn't it? It's a Leinster win.
Yep.
Yeah, there's no doubt.
The big game of the weekend is Ulster, and, you know, Brendan, they're taking on Bath. Interesting for me, no Stuart McCluskey in the Irish squad. They have the nice balance at the moment of guys that are getting rewarded, but also players with a chip on their shoulder. How do you think this will go?
I'd see three of them. Two of them with chips on their shoulder, and one of them not with a chip on his shoulder, but nevertheless feeling that he needs to justify his position. The first one you've mentioned, who is Stuart McCluskey, who was playing really well, and there was a bit of talk on social media about, you know, this is a bad decision, he should have been included. mostly coming from Ulster folks. I think the question would be, if you were not to include Stuart, or if you were to include Stuart McCluskey in the Irish squad, who would you take out? Which poses a different question. He is playing very well, and I think he will probably do so again for Ulster in this. The other one is Jordy Murphy, who missed out in the one-day squad before Christmas and has missed out again now. And this is a fellow who went north pretty much at Joe Schmidt's instigation in order to deepen the pool for the World Cup, and is now surplus to requirements at international level currently. And the third lad is Tom O'Toole, who doesn't have a chip on his shoulder, but nevertheless is thinking, Jesus, I mean, this is the big time. I've just been picked in the Ireland Six Nations squad. I'd be interested to hear BJ's take, but while Tom is rated big time as an athlete, I think it might be accepted that scrummaging is he's in the foothills of the climb on that one.
BJ, all tight heads have a chip on their shoulder, don't they? Tom O'Toole, how do you rate him?
Yeah, look, as Brian alluded to, he's an athlete, and I suppose that comes with time up front. You know, time spent in the scrum, and there's no doubt that you need to be in that cauldron. You know, you're going to be taught lessons, but that's the only way you grow up front there. You know, I suppose when you look back on your time learnt, you know, that's when you learn those tricks to get out of the tough situations and find your way when you are coming up more experienced guys. And I suppose he's got Rob there and Jack right next to him, and then he's got obviously the guys behind him like Hendo as well, Ian Henderson. And you know, they kind of will work well with him. And I suppose as I've alluded to as well with scrummaging, it's a pack performance that know what they need at the specific time. So they'll be well aware of the Bath side, where they'll be kind of countering them. And we know Bath being a premiership side, they'll be coming to them up front. So you know, they'll be well aware of that.
BJ, you've been up there. How important is this for Ulster? You know, they, for the first time now, their destiny is in their own control, the opportunity to kick on.
Yeah, it's a really exciting time for Ulster. I think they've been building now for a number of weeks. I don't think they've kind of lost the game there now for 18 or 19 games on a trot. You know, it's a sold-out Kingspan Stadium. You know, big day for the guys coming out at just about after 3 on a Saturday. So a big day, for Ulster rugby and knowing they've got everything to play for. Just about in their hands. I suppose still a lot to play for. Bath come off there over a bad loss on the weekend. Away. I think also really be confident going into this, and I think they will really put in a big performance, and I think they'd kind of back themselves to get a bonus point.
Brendan, before we leave it go, do you see it that way as well?
Yeah, the interesting element in this was that Ulster season their European season could have gone one or two ways. And if you remember that opening game in Bath in round one, they were heading for defeat, and then Jacob Stockdale intercepted at the tail end of the game, stopping Rocco Degouni from scoring in the corner, which would have given Bath the win. It was one of those kind of sliding doors moments. So I'd say Bath certainly will have the hump that their season has gone south on the back of, I think, losing that game. So that may fuel some degree of interest and energy from them. But yeah, I'd go along with BJ. It has a 5-point look to it.
Okay, guys, thanks so much for joining us. Let's hope it's a great weekend for the Irish. We're going to take a quick break.
Game on 2FM.
Now, some interesting times for the FAI. Today, they confirmed that Sligo Rovers chairman Martin Hegarty and FAI council member Jerry McEnany are the two candidates in the running to succeed Donal Conway as the president of the FAI. The association confirmed this evening, and they will contest the election on Saturday week, the 25th of January. It is also very interesting times for Shane Lowry, because in an unexpected turn of events, he missed the cut in Abu Dhabi, and Greg Allen is here to tell us what went wrong.
What went wrong was just, I don't know, maybe a bit of anxiety, because he was just not making a whole lot happen today in his round. Bogeyed 17, and that meant that he was pretty close to the cut line. He was actually bang on the cut line. 18, though, is a par 5, and he was beside the green in 2 in a bunker and took 4 to get down. He tried to just be too clever with the first bunker shot. It was a tight pin, and he was very unfortunate. The first bunker shot ended up in the face of the bunker plugged. Anybody who plays golf knows that that's one of those things which is a bit unlucky, but he shouldn't have been there in the first place. He should have just got the ball on the green, two-putted, made the cut, with one to spare or you know, bang on the money. But instead, he went for maybe a little bit too ambitious a shot. But a player of his ability and his skill knows that he can play that shot 19 times out of 20. Unfortunately, this was the one time out of 20 when he didn't. So he left the ball in the bunker and then it plugged in the face. And then he took three to get down, missed the cut by one. I think, you know, knowing Shane's mentality, he'll almost feel like he's probably let people down by doing that, because he's actually made a very good start to the season. Four rounds in the 60s last week in Hong Kong, a final round of 64, second in that tournament, his best tournament performance by miles since he won the Open in Portrush in July. And I think as well, if I was Shane, would I take two top 20s at the start of the season, a top 20 last week and a top 20 this week, which would be good, decent start of the season? I would have taken a second place finish in Hong Kong and a missed cut. I'll take the second place finish in Hong Kong and a fairly, you know, bizarre and random missed cut. It wasn't a bad one. The only thing is, he's the defending champion and he'll feel a bit let down about it all.
Greg, we had such a great chat earlier in the week about Shane and potentially what could be coming down for the track from him in a very positive way. And just listening to you now, you almost sound a little bit disappointed.
Look, you know, it's only one tournament. It's January, it's mid-January. By the time we get to middle of March and we get into the main meat of the World Golf Championship season, when he's going to go over to America and play in the WGC in Mexico, this will be old news and will seem utterly irrelevant in many respects if he starts playing well. The only thing was that he's the defending champion in Abu Dhabi, and you know, you go there and you're paired with Tommy Fleetwood and Brooks Koepka, the world number one and the man who he obviously faced down in Portrush, and it's a, you know, a terrific three ball to be in, and then you miss the cut and it's almost like it's embarrassing. And Shane is such a normal human being that he'll find it very difficult to put a positive spin in that. But by tomorrow, even by tonight, I'm sure he's fine. He just realises that these things happen in golf, so the good days are often going to be made feel like good days when you have bad days like today, and that's the way to treat it.
Greg, just on that though, the kind of mental game of it as defending champ, is that a bit of a dent to his confidence going on?
Yeah, look, I mean, there's no question that, you know, you go there and his picture is everywhere. He's one of the touted professionals playing in Abu Dhabi and in one of the, you know, the biggest tournaments at this time of year on the European Tour. It's a Rolex Series event. It's $7 million. Yeah, it's a bit of a dent. But as I said, you know, by March, when they're getting into the big tournaments and you're in the run up to the Masters and you're playing in two World Golf Championship events in March, it'll seem like small potatoes by then. But just at the moment, I'm sure it stings a lot. But look, the bottom line with regard to this is that the Ryder Cup is Shane's big goal for the year. And he started his Ryder Cup qualification campaign quite well. And there are loads and loads of chances to make big money. Like if he finishes top 10 in Abu Dhabi, which would be a pretty good defense of his title, it'll still earn him maybe 100,000 euro or maybe a bit more than that because it's such a big prize fund. But in the great scheme of things, if he follows this up with a second place or a top three finish or a win in the next few weeks, he's going to be playing in Dubai. He loves Dubai. Last year he went to Dubai and finished 12th directly after Abu Dhabi. Normally he'd even be better than that because obviously he had the great sense of winning in Abu Dhabi, and that maybe didn't make him as sharp for Dubai as other times he's been to Dubai. But he loves Dubai and he is going there with the intention to make up for what happened today, I'm 100% sure. Then he goes on to Saudi Arabia and then he goes off to play in the WGC in Mexico, and he'll be up and running and this will seem like old news.
Sure, Greg, because there is a long year ahead. Thanks so much for coming in. Let's take a quick break.
Game on 2FM.
Donica, we have started something. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing.
We've created a monster.
I think we might have. People are texting in looking for shout outs.
Brilliant.
Now, they're probably looking for shout outs from Marty, but 100%. Look, I think you'll do.
No, I won't do. My tan isn't as good, but I'll give it a go. But you know what, it made me think, like, Marty's inspirational, but he's also a real motivator, Marie, isn't he?
He's such a positive guy, he really is.
I think we need a little bit of Marty every week.
Well, he's down there now, you can try and nab him and see if you can arrange it.
Do you know what I'd love? Marty's Motivational Mondays.
To get you going every Monday.
Imagine it, he'd gee you up every Monday, get you through that hump.
He really would, to be fair now, I'd listen to him anyway.
Yeah, he's infectious.
So a couple of the shout-outs that we got in. The Newtown School under-15s rugby team are looking for a shout-out. Maybe you can do that, Donegal.
Yeah, absolutely. Best of luck to Newtown. Hope it goes well for you. Enjoy your rugby, though.
Yeah, at that age, very important, is it?
Have fun.
Of course, this one is definitely for you. Can you please let the people in North Sligo know that the McSharries are Ireland's fittest family and they're going to be attending the Operation Transformational National Walk Day in Grange County, Sligo tomorrow?
Whoa. Look at that, the McSharries crossing over to different Operation Transformation. They're doing it all.
So they're big stars now.
I actually went a week without mentioning it and you brought it up.
Oh, wow. I need to go and have a talk with myself after that. So, Donica, it is a big weekend for rugby, as we might have mentioned once or twice. I'm happy, actually, that it's when it's rugby we're talking about. You can mention that as often as you want.
Yeah, OK, fair enough. But it is a big weekend, Marie. This is where it all comes down to, you know. Every match has an implication onto the other one, so it's a good weekend for rugby.
You'll be out with the abacus, will you?
It's tough. Yeah, like, you're slagging, but you are actually working out. Every bonus point matters to other teams. And for Leinster this weekend, it's huge, because if they get top seeding, not only do they get a home quarter final, but they could get a home semi final as well. But, and like, whatever about your travelling support, as we're seeing with Saracens and every team now, revenue, it matters that you could fill out a stadium.
Well, RTÉ reporter Damien O'Meara got the thoughts of Leinster's head coach, Leo Cullen.
It's a quick turnaround into the game, so. Yeah, like, the guys were well managed over the Christmas period. It's been well documented, so guys are pretty fresh. Came through the weekends well, in relatively good shape. So, yeah, as you say, trying to get the job done, finish the job now, try and get as high a seeding as possible. So it becomes quite clear, really, the way the other pools unfolded at the weekend. So you win the game, get a top seed, and we can move on then. And obviously, we get a bit of a break here. The provincial guys do. Some guys go into national camp then after that, and everyone can look forward then with a bit of excitement for obviously the short term, where everyone sits, but also obviously then beyond that, to have a quarter final to look forward to. And, you know, ideally we're at home for a quarter final, but that relies on what we do this week. And you know, we know it's not going to be easy against Benetton, because they're a very well coached team and a team that causes a lot of problems.
Can you put your finger on why that is, that they seem to cause Leinster problems time and time again that other teams don't necessarily do on such a regular basis?
I think when you get used to playing against certain teams as well, there's certain, you know, clashes of styles as well, and the way they defend, the way they attack, you know, they've, you know, we talk pretty regular to their coaches as well, so they have a pretty good understanding as what we're trying to do. So they get to see us, you know, they get to try things against us over a longer period of time, and hence we've had some really good tussles with them. You know, very tight game in round one of the Pro 14, and obviously the game in the RDS in round one of Europe as well, which was a pretty even contest for large parts. You know, we score, but then, you know, we are find ourselves under a fair bit of pressure as well, and they managed to slow us up well, pretty effectively. And, you know, that period, you know, both teams, I think, are trying to just get a bit of cohesion in their groups. And, you know, Treviso, very similar challenge to us in terms of missing whatever it was, 14 or 15 players go to the World Cup. And then you're trying to reintegrate all those guys back in. You have a other group of players that have been going okay in their absence. So that's the challenge for both teams. So I think the fact that they obviously know us well as a group, I've played against them numerous times, hence there's that sort of familiarity with both teams and a clear understanding of what both teams are trying to do as well.
Has it surprised you at all how well this 13-week block that so much has been spoken about has gone, and how dominant you've been for the most part over the course of it?
Yeah, like, we did a lot of planning for this World Cup season, because we knew 4 years ago how tricky this season was. You know, the club is in a much more stable position in terms of the senior teams, so that has made things a lot easier. But yeah, there's lots of us have been around 4 years ago to understand the challenges of this period, where if you go out to World Cup and it gets congested quite quickly. So being very clear in some of the messaging, the fact that, you know, a lot of players have come through, younger players have come through, the depth has been good, the competition has been good, you know, in terms of the injury profile of the team, being able to rotate guys, even though there's plenty of injuries in the group as well, like all teams. It's definitely a bit of survival of the fittest stuff you see with a lot of teams out there at the moment. So, yeah, there was a lot of planning went into, a lot of work behind the scenes. And yeah, there's obviously been some good rewards off the back of that planning. But most importantly, the attitude of players has been fantastic as well. So the guys that didn't get selected for the World Cup, their attitude has been top drawer. And then, you know, guys, when they come back from the World Cup, you know, their attitude has been really good as well. So then it makes it a lot easier.
Just to finish, is history a motivator for you as the season goes on? There's so much spoken about the potential to go through the year unbeaten. Ultimately, it'll be judged by what silverware rests in reception downstairs when you come back for pre-season. But a win this weekend would be 16 wins on the bounce, would be a new record. Is that a motivator or just a byproduct of what you do week in, week out?
It's definitely more of a byproduct, I think. Yeah, like we want to go out and win every weekend, every game that we play. So, like, you know, like, it's what are we targeting? We're targeting to win every weekend. You know, we do chop and change the team a fair, but we're still picking teams that we think are going to do the job and go and get a positive result off the back of a positive performance, etc., etc. So, and you have to compliment the squad. You know, you go away to, you know, whatever, Galway was a good win down there with, you know, with a lot of guys come back in. We made a lot of changes from away in Lyon, which again, tough place to play, to away in Glasgow the following week, away in Northampton the week after that, away in Munster. You know, some good, really good wins on the road, which has been pleasing, yeah, because lots of guys have had to come into the team at different stages. So, yeah, it's just same as usual for us really this weekend. You know, we don't really look at anything like that. That's kind of, you know, it's making sure we stay the course and control our own destiny. It's all those things, you know, like get a high seeding as possible. But that's sometimes within the game, you know. Sometimes you're behind in the game and you need to scramble to get a losing bonus point, and maybe that's enough to get you to the next step stage. So it's making sure we just stay in control of our destiny, ideally. And that's the very similar in the Guinness Pro 14, that we want to just make sure we manage everything so we're in the best possible shape.
That was Leo Cullen there speaking to Damien O'Mara ahead of their Champions Cup clash with Benetton. Donica, before we move on to the Punters Council, which is coming up next, woohoo, just as someone who is a Munster legend now at this stage.
Oh, stop it, you.
When you hear Leo Cullen there talking about being unbeaten and Leinster's success, like, what are your thoughts?
You never begrudge anyone else's success, but you want it to be your way, and there's always teams setting the standard. And to be fair to Leinster, they have not only set the standard within Ireland over the past number of years, but they've also set it in Europe. So the Irishman in me is delighted that that's happening within the setup, but the Munster man in me, you always want it to be you. And the thing about it is, Marie, careers, actually, I know, like, and it's crazy, I was lucky enough to knock 20 years out of it, but they're really, really short. And in the end of it, you got to have something to show for it. And those Leinster players, I know everyone goes on about the size of their squad. All you'll judge is the success. And when you can create a successful bubble, you drive it on and you grab all around you. You get as selfish as you can and you don't worry about anyone else. So, look, of course, when you went out against them, you wanted to knock lumps out of them. When you played with them in green, you loved them to bits. But as a Munster man, do I want to see us top of the tree? Absolutely, every time.
So I wasn't here for the Punters Council last week. How did it go? Talk me through it.
Hey, oh, poor old Leon. We'll be chatting to him soon, but God love him. He's his work cut out with Ruby. We've got to keep him away from him.
He's on the line now, so he can tell us himself. Leon, you survived.
I did, Marie. Good evening. I was at that same event you were at last Friday night, the Soccer Writers. But Ruby, by God, he put me through it last week. Carefully selected. I think we pushed him all the way out to 9-4. I think he ended up something like an 8-15 shot. But look, it was great. It's another winner. And that's what we're here for, to try and help clubs or charities get a few quid on a Friday night.
Yeah, absolutely. Leon, just before you go on, how did Marie do at the Footballers Awards?
Excellent, Donica. Excellent performance. Yeah. Multifunctional. Had to handle a lot of, let's just say, a lot of characters last week. But it was a good night. I think hopefully the Football Association and everything got to do with football is on the right path at the minute. So here's keeping our fingers crossed.
Absolutely. Well, the place nearly fell down last Friday without you, Marie. So I'm glad to get you back.
I am glad to be back as well. And we have our punter on the line. Sean, how are you? Can you tell us about your club, please?
Not too bad, Marie. How are you?
I'm great.
My local club, it's Ballymun GAA. Basically, we're a Gaelic club here in Ballymount, West Wicklow. Junior A level we play, so every bit of funding, you know, it helps.
Yeah, sure. Brilliant. Does. So, Leon, here are our bets. Alan Cawley, he has gone for a treble. Brighton to beat Villa, Norwich to beat Bournemouth and Chelsea to beat Newcastle. What have you got for us?
Works out, Marie, a little over 4-1 for Alan's Premier League treble. We'll push it out to 7-1 for the Cawley treble.
Okay, Cawley treble, I like that. Jane Mangan, is the magic of light on the Mears hurdle at Ascot?
Yeah, here's hoping, Marie. Jesse Harrington's stable are in red hot form at the minute. Robbie Power takes the ride on this one at Ascot tomorrow. It's a 9-4 chance. We'll push Magical Ice out to 4-1.
What have you got for us, Leon? You always have a great Boyle Sports booster.
Yeah, I'm going to stick with the football this week, Marie. I think I'm going to go with Liverpool to beat United on Sunday. I think Norwich can beat Bournemouth, even though they're right down the bottom of the league. Bournemouth have got so many injuries, and I think Norwich at home are always a decent side. They actually beat Man City there earlier in the season. And I think Leicester can get back to winning ways against another team, Burnley, who are going down that table at a rate of knots. So it works out at 4-1. Again, I'll push the Boyle Sports boost out to 7-1.
Donica, you're up.
No, have I?
You have to push for better.
No, leave Sean have a pick and then we'll have a go. Which one do you fancy there, Sean?
Oh, no, go on. You give us your option there. Go on.
Leon, you probably don't have it, but I'm looking for a miracle. Munster to qualify for the quarterfinals. What would you give me on that? Would you just tell me go away?
I'll tell you what, go away. We're trying to win money, Donica. We're trying to win money for this lad. But in fairness to Munster, last week played well for a lot of the game, but then just kind of faded away, didn't they, towards the second half?
Yeah, that's the way the game's going. Sean, what do you fancy?
I'll go with Magic of Light tomorrow to win.
And what was that at, Leon?
Well, I was going to go 4-1, but go on, because it's Robbie Power and Jesse Harrington, we'll go 5-1. She's only a 9-4 chance, so you're getting more than double the odds there for charity.
Oh, very good. And we know you've had a tough few weeks dealing with Ruby, Leon, so we're not going to absolutely drive you crazy. Thanks so much, though. Sean, do you play a bit with your club?
I do indeed, yeah. We're back training there now at the moment, so slogging away.
And tell me, what games are coming up?
The fixtures are out next week, so we'll find out then, but it's just pre-season at the moment, so let's just get the legs move and get back into it, you know.
Oh, pre-season, you don't miss that, Leon.
No, I certainly don't. No, we don't miss pre-season and those cold winter nights. No way.
Leon, as always, thank you so much. Sean, best of luck. Thanks for joining
us.
Thanks
very much. Cheers. 2FM.
Okay, it's Friday, so we're turning to racing and we're delighted to be joined by Don McLean and Jane Mangan. Jane, we've stood Ruby down for the weekend. He was getting a few things wrong, so myself and Marie are going to handle it. We just thought he was a little bit off on his horse knowledge over the last few weeks.
Oh, jeez. Well, look, no better people to take over the mantle. Marie has been telling me what to do there the last couple of weeks, so I'm interested this weekend to see her point of view.
Yeah. And we'll chat.
I'd like to see you say that to Ruby's face, Donica.
No, I am very brave when he's not in studio. And I actually know he's in England today as well, so hopefully he won't hear it.
When he's here, you just offer him tea and biscuits and ask him, can you do anything for him?
Don, I was actually rubbing his feet the other night.
Yeah, that's surprised. Yeah. I know. Ruby, he's a good stand-in, all right. He's a good backup to have, isn't he?
Yeah, very true. We'll kick it off, guys, with the Clarence House Chase in Ascot on Saturday, the big rematch. Don, who do you fancy in it?
Yeah, look, it's the rematch between Defi de Soy and On the So, Donica. And Defi de Soy is favourite, which you understand why he beat On the So the last time. He's the younger horse. He's 7. On the So's just turned 12. Like he's just a remarkable racehorse, On the So. And even as an 11, nearly 12-year-old, the last time at the Tingle Creek Chase in December, he put it up to Defi de Soy, and he was coming back at him going to the line. And even Barry Geraghty, I kind of thought Defi de Soy maybe was idling on the run to the line, but Barry Geraghty seemed to think that he was given his all and he just got to the line, was On the So. He's just an unbelievable horse. It's going to be even softer ground now at Ascot tomorrow than it was at Sandown, and that'll suit On the So better. Look, Defi de Soy, he's a potential champion chase horse, and he's the young horse on the up. He continues to progress, but it's not a given that he's going to beat him again. You know, if the ground is very, very testing, On the So will love that. And he's a bigger price than Defi de Soy. I'd probably have them, you know, you'd probably bet even money each of two, really, Donica. Whereas at the minute, it's shade of odds on Defi de Soy, and On the So's a 6-4 or 13-8 shot. So I think On the So, you know, it's not really a race to have a bet in, but I just have On the So closer in the market to Defi de Soy than he is.
Jane, for everyone outside, it's great when you get a head-to-head like this. Is it the same for you, or is there anyone else in the field that you think people are writing off?
No, I do think it's a match, and I do think it's probably best, you know, sometimes numerically when there's a small number of runners, it doesn't, you know, I prefer a small number runner race than a 20 runner race with horses potentially getting in the way of the main horses. Defi de Soy and Undeso on ratings are head and shoulders. Janika actually on ratings is close enough, but he was a distant fourth in the Tingle Creek, and I wouldn't imagine him improving to get near the main two. Some people maybe said that Defi de Soy was idling when he got to the front in the Tingle Creek, but I thought Barry was very good on him on the day. He only held on by a neck. Undeso was really coming at him hard in the last couple of hundred yards after the back of the last. And I would expect it to be a close run thing again. Obviously, Don alluded to the ground. Undeso, it's a key factor for him to have soft ground. He's 12 years of age now. And he really likes this race. He's won it three times in the past. He finished second to, or he didn't actually run it last year when Altior won it. And I think you would write him off at your pearl. You would write him off at your pearl. Defi de Soy is a very good horse. He was last year's top novice. And he's probably on form, leading contender for the Champion Chase this year. But Undeso loves this race.
Don, the Champion Hurdle Trial at Haydock. What can we expect there?
Yeah, this is very interesting as well, Marie. Pentland Hills was, he was the Triumph Hurdle winner from last year, 4-year-old, just turned five. And while he was only fifth in the International Hurdle on his debut this season, he travelled very well through the race. He was probably a little bit keen early on, and he ended up towards the far side in the home straight, which was probably on the worst of the ground, and he just kind of faded up the hill. But he ran very well for a seasonal debutant, taking on the older horses for the first time. So I think, despite the fact that he was beaten, he probably enhanced his reputation as a result. But it is difficult for the four going five-year-olds when they take on the older horses over hurdles off more or less level weights. He still gets a pound. The weight for age scale, it's a sliding scale. The more the season goes on, the less the younger horses get. So he's getting a pound as a 5-year-old. In a couple of weeks, he won't get anything at all. But yeah, he's favourite. I think you can understand why he's favourite again. But I'd just be a little bit worried about the fact that he's a 5-year-old taking on older horses. Durasso, Joseph O'Brien sends Durasso over, and he's a fascinating contender. The last time we saw him, he won a chase, a Grade 2 chase, the Webster Cup at Navan back in March. He beat Cadmium in that race, and Cadmium then went on to Aintree and won the Topham Chase doing handsprings. So Durasso, you kind of maybe expected he'd be back over fences this season, but he was entered in the Grade 1 hurdle at Leopardstown over Christmas. He's entered in the Champion Hurdle, and he's here tomorrow at Haydock in the Champion Hurdle Trial. So it's going to be fascinating to see how he gets on as a hurdling. You've got Cornerstone Lad in there as well, who beat Bouvardaire last time in the Tingle Creek, in the Fighting Fifth Hurdle. And Bally Andy, who finished third behind Epitant in the Christmas Hurdle last time, will probably be better on the softer ground, which should bring his stamina into play. It's another small field, but it's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out.
Jane, who do you fancy in it?
I am scratching my head. I really like Pentland Hills. I didn't maybe think he didn't get the credit he deserved last year when he won at Cheltenham and Aintree. But he is, of the four, the lowest rated horse in the race. And I suppose it's because he was in his own age bracket last year. And the one time he's run in open company was when he did disappoint in the International Hurdle at Cheltenham last time. I like Don. I think I'd forgive him that. I think he raced a bit unprofessionally, a bit fresh. And I don't think Nico really knocked him about when his chance was gone at the back of the last in Cheltenham. I think he's better than we saw last time. Justifiably favourite. Durasso has a lot of potential. It's just a question of how much. And I think this is going to be a real test for him. Four-time winner in France before he even came to Joseph. And when he won the Red Mills Hurdle last year, he beat class horses. He beat Curse of Lyme, Farclaw, Rashan. They set a fair standard. And I am intrigued about Cornerstone Lad. He's a big enough price for a horse who is the highest rated horse in here. He was a progressive handicapper. And obviously, when he beat Bouvardaire in the Fighting Fifth, Bouvardaire subsequently had a serious injury. So I wonder, can we take that literally? I'm really dubious about committing to any one of these horses. I think a lot of them are bubbling under. Maybe there's a dark horse going to emerge for the Champion Hurdle here, but they'll have to be impressive because this isn't as deep a race as some of the other trials.
John, just staying with Haydock, the Peter Marsh Chase. What do you fancy there?
Yeah, look, it's an interesting handicap, Marie. It always is. I suppose Acting Lass's favourite, and Acting Lass strangely is a gelding. You'd think he's a mare, but he's not. He's a gelding. he's 9 years old, but he's fairly likely race as a 9 year old. I suppose he was beaten last time by Regal Encore at Ascot. He went up another £3 for that. We're kind of getting to the level. We're getting to kind of know his level, and I think he might be a vulnerable favourite. Prime Venture is kind of second favourite, but he's probably a better horse at Chepstow than he is anywhere else, and definitely Red, who is a very, very good horse, but he might just, he's 11 years old now, he might just not be as good as he was. I think there's a mare in there, Midnight Tune, Anthony Honeyball's mare. She's a very likely raced mare. She loves soft ground, and it's going to be very soft at Haydock and at Ascot tomorrow. She only just got home last time at Exeter, but that was over 2 miles or an extended 2 miles. She's better over three. She'll appreciate the step up and trip. She loved the ground. She's in off a mark of 136, which is it's only £3 higher than she was when she ran really well in a race at Plumpton there last season. She's obviously had her issues. She only raced twice last season, but she's a progressive mare who's got the potential to be ahead of her handicap mark, who'll love the ground, who'll stay the trip, and against one or two at the top of the market who might be vulnerable, I think she's an interesting horse in there.
Jane, Don mentioned Ascot there, and it'll be soft in the Betfair 365 Mares Hurdle. Who do you fancy in that?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Magical Light. Like a lot of people, I think she ran a huge race in the Aintree National last year. She was, you know, in really good spirits last year, and I thought she was very good last time. She won this race 12 months ago and is the highest rated mare in here. She deserves to be near top of the market, but she actually isn't, because Papagana of Oliver Sherwood's is top of the market, having been third in a grade one last time behind Lamy Surge and The World's End. I would be taking her on. I thought that race that The World's End won was a grade one in name, but not in nature. I thought the front two, the Lamy Surge, curled up in the last 200 yards and the race kind of stopped, whereas I don't think that'll happen the likes of Magical Light in this race. She apparently, according to Robbie Power, heads to Cheltenham if all being well after this, and then obviously goes back for another crack at the Aintree National. So big targets for this mare. They obviously feel she's in the form of her life, that those targets remain on the table. So I think, while she's not favoured at the moment, she'd be the one I'm siding with, especially on a track we know she loves. A flat track, I think, is important to this mare.
Don?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Agree with all a lot of what Jane said there. I think Papagana might have been a bit flattered by her run the last day in The World's End, for all that she was progressive before that. But Magic of Light, I mean, you can't not like Magic of Light. Her run in the Grand National last year was an unbelievable run. She was a 66-1 shot. Paddy Kennedy gave her a super ride. And I suppose, you know, the fact that she was a 66-1 shot meant she was kind of under the radar then. But she won this race last year, and this has been a good race in the past. Le Bagot Roi won it a couple of years ago. Vroom Vroom Mag won it a couple of years before that. So yeah, look, it's a good mare's race. You've got San Solano in there as well, but you kind of think, having a look at Magical Light, you kind of think maybe she's just getting ready to go back to Aintree this year. But it doesn't seem like that's the be all and end all. Often you have Aintree horses, Grand National horses, they hide their light under a bushel for most of the season until the handicap ratings come out. But that doesn't seem to be the case with Magic of Light. And yeah, I think she should be nearly favourite for that.
And Jane, turning to Turles, you were saying it earlier, it's the biggest day of the year for them. The Horse and Jockey Hotels Chase, how do you think that'll go down? My old buddy Notebook, yeah, as I was calling Footpad.
Yeah, this is a cracking race. This is a big day for Turles. It's a very popular track down here, and it's good to see the horses come out, because this track takes a lot of hard weather, a lot of hard beating all year, and this is a quality renewal of this race, formerly known as the King Loch Braes, now sponsored by the Horse and Jockey Hotel. And I think the former Arkell winner Footpad will lead the market. I think he's the highest rated horse in here, and he receives weight off every horse in the lineup. He won on his seasonal debut actually at Turles in November, and was running a good race in the King George before he didn't quite get home. So I think 2.5 miles is probably his optimum trip. I'd be hoping, if everything went well here, that he might be one for the Ryanair in March. Of his opposition, I love Hardline. I think he's a tremendously consistent horse. He is a dream to have anything to do with, because he usually always runs his race. He ran $1 million in the John Durkin when he was second to Min, but he disappointed last time at Leopardstown, and he's going to have to bounce back. Vodarev Real Steel bring a good level of form. Vodarev, a grade one novice himself, and Real Steel Premier Handicap winner in Punchestown last May, and then came out and won a Down Royal in November Grade 2 race. But Footpad sets the standard here. If all being well, I think over 2.5 miles, getting weight from all his rivals, it'll take a huge performance for him to get beaten.
Don, before we get your opinion on that race, how important is it for Turles? Like Jane was saying there, you know, biggest day of the year, for us to get out and get around.
Ah, yeah, and it is a great day. It is important for Turles, but it's a massive day there. And like as Jane said, they're a great track. They race during the winter when a lot of other tracks can't race. And, you know, the soil down there is brilliant. Mm-hmm. It's like this race, they've been rewarded with this race, Dunica, because it's a cracking race. Like the entries were very strong and you just hope that a lot of them stood their ground. Kaiser Black was in there as well. Pat Doyle's horse, be interesting to see him whenever he reappears. But Willie Mullins has Footpad and Real Steel and Voix du Rêve. Gordon Elliott has Hardline in there. And Jessica Harrington has Jets. So it's a, you know, again, it's a relatively small field, not as small a field as some of the races at Ascot or Haydock, but it's a top class renewal. It's a Grade 2 race and it deserves every inch of its Grade 2 status. You know, with Footpad in there, like the multiple Grade 1 winner, Voix du Rêve, as Jane said, also multiple Grade 1 winner. Real Steel ran a big race to win at Down Royal, and then probably ran better than his finishing position suggests in the John Durkin chase last time, behind Main and behind Hardline. Actually, he finished fourth, behind Hardline finished second. He just kind of got a bit squeezed out of it in the run around the home turn and then kept on. But Footpad, it looks like this is his ideal trip. They tried the King George with him and they were right to have a go at it, because when he won at Thurles, that was over 2.6 miles and he saw it out well, albeit in lesser company. He didn't get home, as Jane said, in the King George, so back over 2.5. That's probably very close to his optimum trip. And it was great to see him back the last time at Thurles, because he jumped really, really well. He travelled well for Daryl Jacob. And Real Steel, you know, I suppose it's a bit disappointing in the John Durkin that he wasn't a wee bit closer. But Willie Mullins said at the start of the season, he probably has to go right-handed, and Thurles is a right-handed track. So this is a good race for him as well. It's hard enough to pick between the Willie Mullins horses, not to mind picking what's going to win the race.
Is that important though, Jane, that the quality is there? You know, you could look at the numbers, but that's what maybe everyone wants, like Don was saying, they're all the best in show.
Yeah, well, I suppose in soccer terms, if you have a Cristiano Ronaldo versus a Lionel Messi, it doesn't matter if you're surrounded by Jane Mangan and Don McLean. Once those two players are on the pitch, they're fine. Yeah. I think the boring way to look at it is, there's five runners in here and they'll average out the rating to make sure the Grade 2 status of the race is solidified. And sometimes races get upgraded or downgraded year on year if the competition or the calibre of horse lining up in these races isn't up to scratch or is actually better than the status of the race. So that is important for Turles as well, that they keep this a Grade 2, and who knows down the line when Limerick upgraded their novice chase to Grade 1, it was justified when you see the likes of Sam Crow and Faheen and Hardline and Getabird all lining up in those races. So yeah, five runners in here, three of them are Willie Mullins's. Tactics, I think, is always very interesting, because it's easier maybe to read the race when you have five quality horses in here rather than 15 filling the numbers and perhaps potentially causing problems for the five quality horses. You know what I mean? So it's always very tactically interesting to watch visually when you have a small runner field.
Donica, I'm guessing that when Jane was talking about Messi and Ronaldo, she was actually talking about us.
Carrying Ruby. Absolutely.
Don, I know you're really looking forward to the Coolmore Mares novice chase and Thurles as well.
Yeah, look, it's a good race, Marie. It's a Grade 2 race. Willie Mullins probably holds the key again. There's no betting on it yet. I'd say Ellie Mae will probably be favourite. She was good the last time at Cork and she beat Augusta Gold, who reopposes. I thought Cut the Mustard actually ran very well at Limerick over Christmas. Like she wasn't really, didn't seem to be travelling early on, and then she stayed on really well for Mikey Fogarty to go on. She won well in the end. She came back on the bridle around the home turn and then stayed on really well. And another Willie Mullins horse, Paul Tennant, rides her. Mark Walsh, who rides for JP McManus, Ellie May's owner, he rides her. So it'll be interesting to see how those two go. And you've got Caravation in there as well. William Flood's horse, Philip Dempsey's trains. She might have been a wee bit lucky to win last time at Naas, but she's an honest-to-God mare who was a good hurdler, good progressive hurdler last season. But I'd just be interested to see how Cut the Mustard will go. She's stepping up a little bit in trip from Limerick. I think, you know, maybe she could even get a wee bit further than 2.5 miles, but on soft ground, that should bring her stamina into play.
Jane, who do you fancy in that Coolmore Mares novice chase?
Yeah, I like Ellie May, justifiably favoured, I think. She holds Augusta Gold and Tintangle on her form at Cork. But I do like Carvation as well. I think she's run some very good races in defeat and beginner's chases. She bumped into Catchback, Facu de Derry and Bopome in a couple of beginner's chases. And while she might be a fortuitous winner at Nace last time when the favourite Good Time Tara came down, she deserved to get her day. She was a good bumper mare. She was a dual hurdle winner as well. I think she's a mare that will buck out in front, and there'll be a bit of pace on. Augusta Gold will probably go with her. I hope they don't set it up for a closer like Cut the Mustard, but Luke Dempsey's back from an injury, riding for his dad Philip. He'll know the mare very well. I think she's a mare that might, because she's not coming from a big fancy yard like an Elliott or a Mullins, she might represent a bit of value on the day. We don't have prices yet, but she's a mare that'll give her running.
Yeah, Don, slower weekend, but what are you most looking forward to?
Yeah, look, the horse and jockey chase, Donica, that's a cracking race. That's on Sunday at Thurles, so that's a highlight really of the day for sure. And then tomorrow, I suppose the big races at Ascot and Haydock, you know, the Defi de Soy v Undeso, that rematch, where I think and hope Undeso can gain his revenge.
Yeah, Jane, it's probably the exact same for you, is it?
Yeah, I think the heart is telling me Undeso, but the head is really saying that the 7-year-old Defi de Soy should be beating him. But it'll be enthralling nonetheless. It's a great matchup between the pair. And then I'm off to Thurles on Sunday to see some quality action there.
Brilliant. You're always torn, Jane, aren't you, between your heart and your head?
Is that a bad thing, though? Is it really?
No, it's not.
At least I know the difference between, I suppose, what I should and shouldn't be thinking.
Absolutely, but you can't give in to your heart sometimes, isn't it?
Oh, well, I suppose when I'm saying I'm going with my heart and my head, the head usually rules, and Defi de Soy will probably win. But sure, it would be boring if we said that at the start of the programme.
Very true, absolutely. Don and Jane, thanks so much for joining us. As always, let's look forward to a great weekend of racing.
Game on 2FM.
Now it is time to talk Premier League, and I have to say I haven't been as excited about a match in a very, very long time. And Alan Cawley is with us in studio. Alan, Man United, Liverpool, where do you even start?
It's the fixture we all look forward to, I suppose, at the start of the year, Marie. Unfortunately for Man United fans at the moment, though, and myself included, we're nowhere near the level of Liverpool at the moment. So I know everyone's still hyping it up, and you hear former players interviewed about it, and they all still say it's the biggest fixture in the calendar. I would question that at the moment, because there is a massive gap between the clubs. But of course, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer will argue against that, and he feels as though they're on the right track. I'm not so sure, but if you look at the game earlier in the season, obviously they're the only ones to take points off Liverpool. So he will try and go in with some sort of a game plan to stifle Liverpool again, I'm sure. There was a bit of needle in the press conferences because he felt Klopp was being disrespectful, saying there was negative tactics involved with Man United in the first game. But I think that's probably just a reflection of the gap between the clubs, that Man United, if they take Liverpool on head to head in a game, they'll get destroyed.
So obviously, Alan, you're looking at it with your United glasses. Marie's got her Liverpool ones on. Thankfully, we've David Connolly on the line to bring a bit of balance to it. David, how do you see it going?
Well, look, I'm not going to sit on the fence here and get splinters. I'm afraid I think United are going to get comprehensively beaten. You know, I can't see them. I looked at all the different ways they could line up, and I can't see a way that they can keep them out. Now, I know they got a good result against them earlier in the season, but you know, say they play Lindelof and Maguire as the two centre-halves. I mean, they were destroyed. Lindelof was destroyed against Man City. They were woeful against Wolves. Wan-Mata has been the best player the last two games. There's talk he might not even start. So, I don't know. What do? They can't bring Phil Jones back. He had a nightmare against City as well. Eric Bailly's not fit. They can't play a back three. I just wonder what they can do. If Rashford's not fit, it's a real worry for them, because I've got to be honest, I look at Fred, I look at Matic, there's no way they're going to keep up with Liverpool's midfield. So I've got a real worry for this United team against Liverpool.
And Alan, even like when you just look at the trouble that Rashford has caused Liverpool in the past, Trent Alexander-Arnold in particular, to miss him now, like, I think it just nearly finishes their chances.
Oh, absolutely, Marie. Yeah, and I would echo all that, even though, as I say, I am a Man United fan. I would echo everything that David has said. I fear for Man United going to Anfield on Sunday because, as I said already, the gap between the clubs is massive, and you go through the players, as Dave outlined, I'm just not sure where Man United can hurt them. And obviously the only area where you would feel they may be able to hurt them, as we've seen in some of the games, that when they have taken on the bigger clubs, is on the counter attack. But as you rightly say, if Rashford is injured, Marie, he's their main goal scoring threat, he's their best player, they're heavily reliant on him. If he's not playing, I give them no hope whatsoever, whatever hope I give them even before that. But if he's not playing, they can forget about it.
David, just on this though, like, wouldn't you be licking your lips if you're Man United? It's Liverpool coming unbeaten in 38 games. Everyone's writing you off. You're still Man United, one of the biggest clubs in the world. It's the perfect game for them to redeem themselves.
Yeah, look, it could be. Don't get me wrong. It really could be. But you look at how they performed against, you know, sides with real quality. You know, think of the Man City game. You know, Man City, you know, were able to rest the two best centre forwards, or one of the two best centre forwards in the league, and they still, you know, made such light work of them. So yes, it might be easy, but when you look at, you know, their recovery runs, you look at their athleticism, you know, what does he do in the middle of the park? He doesn't have a number 10. Jesse Lingard can't play as a 10 at the minute. Mason Greenwood's played as a 10. He can't do it. The only player I think is Wan-Mata. So Wan-Mata plays centrally as a number 10. You know, if there's no Rashford, well, where does Dan James play? He might play left wing. Well, who's playing right wing? Mason Greenwood coming in off the left, he struggled at times when he started. So I just worry that they're nowhere near at the level that they should be. And I don't think he has the options to do anything different, like play a flat five. Look, Brandon Williams has been brilliant. Wan-Bissaka bombs on forward. But they can't do that against Liverpool. If they do that, I think they'll get destroyed. Now, what you would say is, for all, you know, their good play against Tottenham, Tottenham still had two really good chances and should have scored. You know, Lo Celso had a gilt-edged opportunity and didn't take it. But I just can't see United keeping Liverpool out. They'll get chances, United. They might get one or two, but if Rashford's not in the team, I think even Martial misses Rashford as much as Rashford missed Martial. So I do worry for them.
Alan, even if they do manage to get in behind the full-backs, you just have Van Dijk and Gomez there, and they're so quick and they're so good as well.
They're so strong, Liverpool, and I suppose you'd fancy them in any match at the moment, Marie, and I don't think it's an over-exaggeration to say that this Liverpool team obviously can go on and probably be one of the best Premier League teams that we've ever seen. And I know that debate has kind of broken out a little bit already, but I think that's a little bit premature. But when you look at the quality that they have, and then you could argue, are they getting the respect that they deserve? Because to go 21 games this season, to win 20, draw 1, obviously they went off to the Club World Cup as well. You look at their form at the end of last season, the latter part, and they've carried all that on. As Dunica said, they're unbeaten in 38 games. Are they getting the respect that they deserve? Because I'm hearing people saying, well, Man City are not at the level. And then you look at the other clubs, United are struggling, Arsenal are struggling, Chelsea are going through a bit of a transitional period. And people are almost making out as if it's a bit of a doddle. But to win that amount of games, and in the fashion that they're winning them as well, I think that's what's been so impressive about Liverpool. And they just have such quality all over the pitch. And we even seen with their backup team, the reserves that played in the cup as well, the young lads that are coming through, Marie, there's such positivity around that club at the moment, and it's a complete opposite when you look over, I suppose, the other side of the country, when you look at Man United down the road. And it's just Solskjaer, I think he's fighting fires every day in press conferences. He came out with that silly comment last week saying that Man City playing their full strength team, he just doesn't fill you with any confidence, or as I've said many times on the show, he doesn't speak with an air of authority that you would expect from a Man United manager, or you would expect from a top quality manager at any club around Europe. So as I've said many times, even though the only little bit of sympathy I have for him is I don't think he has the players, but I don't think he's the right manager either.
Let's hear from him.
We need a very, very good performance to go there and win. But we've proven that we beat City last month. We've had the PSG game. We need to get to the level of those performances, definitely, when you go away against the team that's top of the league. And the last two performances we've had against Liverpool as well, to be fair, we've played them at Old Trafford twice, we've drawn twice and been closest to winning both those games. So we've got some games to look back at, and that will give us some belief and loads of belief that we, on the game, if we perform to our best, we've got a chance to win.
Ollie, a lot, it's going to be your first time as a manager walking into Anfield.
Yeah.
You know it all as a player, but they're going to, obviously, I think the Liverpool crowd will try and make it as intimidating as possible. You're going to see the people there when you arrive on the bus and all the rest of it. They'll make it noisy, atmospheric. Any issues for you, or are you going to embrace that? How much are you going to enjoy that striding through there as a manager after having the successes you've had as a player against Liverpool?
I've had both wins and defeats there, I think, at Anfield as a player. So, of course, you've got to look forward to these games. It's a great, great challenge for our players, again, to play against the leaders of the league. We've done well against them the last couple of times. But as you say, away at Anfield is another matter. It's a game that you've... You can make sure you enjoy it, but it can also be an intimidating place. But then we just got to do all the preparations as well as we can, prepare some of these young players, probably play at Anfield for the first time, and I'm sure they'll be fine.
David, we hear him there, and Alan spoke about the confidence that he leaves out, but just for smarts, looking after guys, putting Marcus Rashford out against Wolves and now losing him maybe this weekend, crazy decision, no?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's been a few of those over this period, and you know, despite what people say, you can't expect these top athletes, you know, just to play game after game after game. And I think one of the worst things is when you have these lads on the bench and then you bring them on, probably expecting them, the lads are, like Rashford, is probably not expecting to even come on. You know, you look at Pepe, can afford to leave, you know, Aguero, Jesus on the bench. You look at Leicester resting Jamie Vardy over Christmas, Southampton resting Danny Ings against Southampton. He comes back and he's scoring goals for fun, a bit like Vardy. You know, to bring Rashford on, when he's so important to you. Look, I get it, the FA Cup, they want to win it. But I thought it was, and he did say it backfired. And it did backfire. And you know what? I look at some of the things that's happened. I know, you know, Ashley Young, a bit like Chris Smalling, a bit like Lukaku. But I look at that and I think, well, that's another leader. Despite what you say, you know, top Premier League player leaving the football club. You know, it's another one like Antonio Valencia gone out of Old Trafford. And I look at what's left and I thought, I don't know, would I rather have Ashley Young there and Antonio Valencia and people like that rather than Fred and Matic and Pereira? I don't know. So I just worry that they're losing a little bit of... you know, those cornerstones of the football club with some of the, look, they might not be at the peak of their powers, those players, but I tell you what, I bet Ashley Young goes on and does brilliant at Inter, you know, and I think Ollie in this time would be maybe better served keeping some of those experienced players.
That Ashley Young move was just completed very, very shortly from Manchester United to enter. Alan, will you miss him?
No. I know, to be fair to him, and as Dave said, I suppose respectfully, he has given 8-9 years good service to the club. I wouldn't have been arguing too much whether him to stay or not. The only bright spark, and even looking at the game the other night, I would agree with Dunica before I actually make the point, but I would agree with Dunica on the Rashford thing. I thought it was madness because Solskjaer said in the interview before the match that Marcus Rashford was carrying a knock. So then for him to bring him on in the Wolves game was madness. And if he is missing against Liverpool, that was a crazy decision. But the only bright spark for me so far with Man United this season has been the young lad Brandon Williams. And again the other night against one of the most dangerous players in the league, that Adama Traore, who's absolutely lightning. I thought he handled him really, really well. So in terms of, I suppose, things to look forward to the future, and I know Solskjaer mentions that he is giving young lads a chance, some of them young lads I don't think are up to the level, but certainly Brandon Williams I think will have a big future at Man United.
Alan, just on it though, like you look at Liverpool, the last 30 league games, the only points they dropped was in that draw to United. So is it, will that be enough for them? Should they park the bus nil all? You know, it's good for Ollie, keeps everything going.
I think if you were to offer Solskjaer nil all now, he'd snap your hand off for it, Dunica.
But Alan, how would you park the bus when you just look at the front three?
Well, I mean,
you're so smug, Marie.
And the good thing about the front three is that, like, there's always one of them in form as well. Firmino, Mane, yeah. Mane, is it Salah's turn? We saw his clip today, or we heard his clip today. He was asked about them dropping points against Manchester United, and he said, yeah, that's because I was injured. So they have that confidence as well.
Yeah, and rightly so, because they have the performances to back it up, every one of them. And if, as you said, Marie, if one of them's having a bad day, the other lad steps in. Firmino was brilliant last week, obviously, against Spurs. Mane was probably the player of the season up until Christmas. Salah's chipping in with the goals. But I think the midfield area as well, sometimes they can get criticised for that, but I think some of the midfielders have been brilliant. Wijnaldum, Henderson, who gets a lot of stick as well, I think he's been fantastic for them this season. They're just quality all over the pitch. The threat that both fullbacks provide as well, obviously Trent Arnold, we all know about him. Robertson on the other side, as we've said many times, they're a brilliant team. I think if you were to offer Solskjaer nil all now, he'd definitely snap your hands off.
David, I've come up with a new formation, a 6-2-2. Do you think Ollie'd go for it?
Hey, look, if he's going to park the bus, he's going to need a big bus. I'm sure that's a line from a film. We're going to need a bigger bus. No, it might be yours, a bigger boat. But just going back to what Marie said there, when Liverpool played Leicester, I was in the tunnel at the end of the game and talking to a few of the, like Adam Lallana, Jordan Henderson after the game, just played with Adam at Southampton. And I just said to him, who's the best player? Who's your best player? And you know, the one player he said, I think he's the best I've ever played with. He said he's incredible, absolutely incredible. And it was Robert Firmino.
Firmino, yeah.
And that took me somewhat, I wouldn't say by surprise, but and only since then I've started looking at him more closely and going back. And, you know, the others, say Salah, Mane, they are definitely a bit greedier. They get more goals, but sometimes they make the wrong decision. But don't get me wrong, they are absolutely incredible players. You know, Firmino had a spell of not scoring for 9 games, but his actual overall game and his intelligence, he's just out of this world. And, you know, a couple of his goals, like the one against Tottenham, was so bright. His one against Leicester, he used the sort of back of Pereira to finish, you know, with his back to goal. He's almost like Kenny Dalglish, you know, he's so bright. And I just thought that was really insightful, you know, that his teammates obviously rate him that highly. But I don't know, maybe from the outside all the attention is probably grabbed by Salah and Mane.
His weak foot as well, we saw him score with that recently, and his touch is just unbelievable.
Well, whatever about the goals, Marie, as well, it's that he links everything together, and I suppose that's why Klopp is mad about him, you know, because in his general play, the way that they play, and obviously the pace that they possess, but he links everything together between the midfield and that attack. I think he's phenomenal, Firmino.
Now we are going to move on and talk about the other games, because there are other games on this weekend. But first, let's hear from Jurgen Klopp.
It's a very, very important football game, like games against pretty much all opponents. That's how it is. I think we have to learn dealing with the with games like this in the right manner. So we did not too bad in the past, but we still can improve. I think the game at United is a good example that we were not at our best in a game where we should be because of the quality of the opponent. We were not bad that day, but that's how it is, and we have to make it more likely that we are at our best in a game like this.
I know you said you've not done badly against Manchester United recently, not done amazingly. I think 5 out of 7 have been draws in the last Premier League matches. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer says, we found a nice way of playing against them. So have you found a nice way for this match to play against them?
I don't know 100% about the results. I know about the games, and they were not games like you would imagine when United plays against Liverpool. Like, that's why I said it's not about how games have been in the past. So there have been good times for Liverpool, good times for Man United, and then there was always one clear favourite and stuff like this, but both teams tried to win it. And I think in the last 2 years the away games were especially strange from that point of view. So it was like, I said it after the game, and I heard Ole got confronted with that as well, that I say that United only defended today, because I felt it in that moment. It's strange when you play against a high quality team, but United still is, and they play the way they play.
So that was Jurgen Klopp speaking about the game that we're all looking forward to, Alan.
Yeah, well, it's a huge game, Marie, and obviously I think the argument has to turn to, I suppose, the discussion in terms of Liverpool going unbeaten, because everybody is saying that the title is over, which I firmly believe it is as well. But can they go the season unbeaten? I just don't know who's going to stop them. I really don't. and it wouldn't surprise me at all. I think they'll hammer Man United on Sunday. I know the texters are not happy giving me a bit of stick, but I think they'll hammer them on Sunday.
Everyone gives you a stick.
No.
David, just quickly before we finish up, Arsenal, they need to get back to winning ways.
Yeah, they do. Big game for them, obviously, against Sheffield United, who are, you know, be a tough nut to crack. You know, they really will come up and done great in the Premier League. So I'm actually at the Emirates tomorrow to watch that one. So I'll be able to report back and tell you what it's like next week.
Okay, guys, thank you very much for joining us. I am looking forward to the analysis on Monday already, I have to say. So that is all we have time for tonight. The official chat show with Blona Tracy is up next. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in.
Game on 2FM. Weekdays from 6.